I think I'm all ready to go, and then I start getting ready to talk, and then I realize that I have to go touch the microphone or the headphone cord, and then I feel like I've been infected, so then I have to use more Purell, and then and then I'll go touch the phone, and then I have to go wipe that down, and then finally I think I'm ready to go. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Roundtable. It is 13 minutes past 9 o'clock on this 23rd day of March, and boy, if you told us it was November, wouldn't it seem like it? It just seems like things are going really slow here lately. We welcome you. We hope you had a safe weekend. We hope you had a good weekend, and we hope you're keeping well. We're worried about you, and we want to make sure that everything is good. We're going to keep doing what we do and try to be as safe in the process as possible. So all of our guests join us from remote locations, and we have a wonderful panel, so we'll get to them in just a moment. I do want to remind you that you can join in on the conversation by emailing us at panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will no doubt be hearing from the governor and the president today. If those come during our time together, we will be covering them live. If not, we'll be broadcasting them when they become available, and hopefully we'll have some updates for you in a little while. In the meantime, let me introduce everybody to you, and we'll get started on what was a really the first full weekend of isolation and self-quarantine for a lot of people, and social media has certainly shown us what people are up to, and people are often very creative, and good for them. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning, Joseph. We had our wonderful 7:50 meeting this morning, the senior staff.
The confab, yeah.
Yeah, at WAMC, and I was outside walking because I wanted to beat the snow. I did my 4 miles, but I have to say I ruined the conference because the trucks were passing and nobody could hear a thing.
Oh, we can hear you. Yeah.
I apologize.
No problem. No problem. We're glad you got the walk in before the snow. It's coming down here, so hopefully
actually it was in the snow.
Yeah.
And it was a fine snow, and there was some accumulation on the side of the road, but it wasn't terrible.
Well, we know one thing about spring snow is that it melts quick, so we will hope for that. Of course, a little bit better because we don't have to worry about sending our kids out to school or driving in it for work because most people are home. So that is something to keep in mind as well. Our political consultant, or a political consultant, she's ours too. It's Libby Post is with us. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm just Ducky. I've got Ira, one of our cats, on my lap. He's very happy to be sequestered with us.
Does
you know how it is?
Does Ira Fussfeld know that you have a cat named Ira?
I don't know. We had two cats. We had George and Ira for the Gershwins. George left us a few years ago, but Ira's over 20 and still hanging in.
Oh, good, excellent. Well, welcome,
yeah.
Ira. And
yeah.
How's the You had a shot in your Facebook page of your beautiful golden retriever just with this afternoon sunshine, and just shimmered.
Yeah, it's a beautiful shot, and she's a little stir crazy.
Yeah, well, aren't we all?
You know, she's just about two, and so she's still a little bit of a puppy. And she's a golden, so she'll be a puppy until, at least she's 10. And so she's a little stir-crazy, wants to keep going outside. So,
well, good to know you're all
you know
there and safe. I do indeed.
Yeah.
The Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI and Director of the RPI IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration, Jim Hendler, is here. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Joe.
Very nice to have you on the program. A delight as always. And our good friend Jim Ketterer is back, a Bard
Yay.
Center for Civic Engagement Senior Fellow and currently Dean of the School of Continuing Education at the American University, Cairo. James Ketterer, good morning, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's nice to be with you, not with you, but nice to be back on the round table. And I guess I could be doing this from Cairo as well, but I'm doing it just a few blocks from the WAMC studios.
So how did you, I am curious, I didn't ask you any of this when we were communicating because I wanted to save it for the radio, but how You were originally, just so people know, you were going to come back before any of this broke. You were going to come back for a week or two, and you were going to be with us. And then you were scheduled to be on, and we were very excited. And then you wrote to us and said, well, because of all this, I obviously won't be traveling. So then you came back. Did you get kicked out, or how did that work in Egypt?
Not that I know of, but I've been kicked out.
I don't mean kicked out, but I mean as far as for your safety.
Yeah, as you said, I was scheduled to come back for a conference, and the conference was canceled, as I think almost all, if not all, conferences are canceled. And then a few days ago, the Egyptian government announced that they'd be closing the airspace for at least 2 weeks, if not more. And the State Department shortly thereafter issued language that said, you know, Americans should either plan to come home or be where they are indefinitely. And they use the word indefinitely, which is not common language for the State Department to use. So I made the decision with the support of the American University to come home for some time. We're working remotely in any case, so I'm working remotely from here. I'm in touch with my colleagues and staff all the time. And the work continues, and the university is doing a great job kind of soldiering on online. And so I'm working on that from here. I also just want to say, maybe we can get into this more in the conversations too, but what people should also keep in mind, what an extraordinary job all of our embassies around the world are doing, the foreign service officers in those embassies. Each of those embassies has an office called American Citizen Services. That few people know about it until they need it, and they really need it now in many places to get out, to get home, to find a place to be safe wherever they are. And they're really unsung heroes, and they should be given lots of credit.
I just want to say we are so lucky to have you back. You know, you have always been a great part of this program, and I am particularly grateful that you're back with us.
Absolutely. We're sorry it's under these circumstances, but boy, it's wonderful to have you. Can you give us before we dive into this, can you give us a world perspective of what it was like in being in Egypt and how they were responding not only to their own crisis, but to what was happening here in the United States?
Yeah, you know, it seems to me that one of the interesting aspects of this crisis is that it's unfolding in stages in different countries at different times. And so it hadn't been hitting Egypt quite as quickly as it did some of the European countries or even the United States. But the Egyptian government has been moving very quickly on things, as I said, that closing of the airspace, closing down schools, closing down universities for a temporary period, and then reassessing and see what happens. But you know, all of the kind of infrastructure, decision-making processes, public health infrastructure of any country is being sorely tested now, and people are scrambling. People are nervous. They're nervous in Egypt as much as they're nervous and deeply anxious here. But people are also staying at home. They have a really active public relations campaign in Egypt to convince people to stay at home. They've closed down in the same kind of way that we're closing down. They're a little bit behind us because the effect has been a little bit behind. So in terms of Egypt, it's lagging a bit because the hit is lagging a bit, but people are coming around to taking it seriously. Of course, in any place, we see it in the U.S., you can see it anywhere, there's always going to be a group of people who refuse for whatever reason to take it seriously because they've been conditioned to not believe experts or they find it inconvenient or what have you. And so that exists everywhere as well, but Egyptians are. I was just we just had a senior staff meeting for my school just before this program started, and you know, people are home. They're working, and they're trying to take care of their families just like we are.
Well, it's a fascinating perspective, and again, I'm so glad you're here with us. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So let's just talk about some of, again, I keep saying this, and I know I'm repeating it over and over again, but it is, I think, because there are so many aspects to the story, and it is really all anyone is talking about or probably should be talking about, but there's so many aspects to it. So I what I've been doing is just kind of throwing out a whole bunch of stuff and grabbing on and letting the conversation take us both through our panelists and from our letter writers. With that said, I'd just like to begin with an article in the Washington Post this morning that says, quote, this from the Washington Post, Robert Costa and Aaron Gregg. President Trump's response to the coronavirus pandemic sparked uproar and alarm among governors and mayors on Sunday as Trump and his administration's top advisors continue to make confusing statements about the federal government's scramble to confront the crisis, including whether he will force private industry to mass produce needed medical items. As deaths climbed and ahead of a potentially dire week, Trump, who has sought to cast himself as a wartime leader, reacted to criticism that his administration has blundered with a torrent of soaring boasts and searing grievances. He tweeted that the Illinois governor, J.B. Pritzker, a Democrat, and others, quote, shouldn't be blaming the federal government for their own shortcomings. We are there to back you up should you fail, and always will be. Trump changed his tone in an evening news conference, however, touting that an amazing relationship, the amazing relationship that he had with New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, also a Democrat, of course, and saying governors he spoke with on Sunday will be, quote, very happy with the upcoming federal response. Alan, let's begin with you in response to that.
Well, you know, I finished a column on this very thing, this very subject recently, which is Andrew Cuomo, of course, is brilliant in the way that he has handled this. Anybody who had tough things to say about Andrew Cuomo, including, you know, me and Chris Churchill and others, have our mouths open that he is so, he has been so spectacular in the way he's handled this. Now, clearly, he has made a deal with the president, which is, I'm not going to say anything bad about you, and you're not going to say anything bad about me. And he has stuck to that. And as a result, hospital ship is coming, maybe a little later than we'd like it, but it's coming. He's getting what he needs out of this president. And at a time like this, let others handle the president's malfeasances, which are so great. But Cuomo, for his part, has done very well, as has the governor of California. They both understand that this is the way that this game has to be played right now, because we know enough about Trump to know that if he's mad at somebody, they get nothing. And New York is doing quite well right now.
Libby Post.
Well, you know, I've been watching the governor's 11 o'clock press conferences and briefings every day, and I've been interested in the rhetoric about being so nice to the president, recognizing that doing anything else would be, you know, bad for New York. And so I was interested that, you know, that sort of his rhetoric sort of mounting up, and all the positives to the president, which, you know, some of us just cringe at but understand politically. And now Trump is you know, being a little more gracious. But there were times on Twitter in the last week where Trump attacked Cuomo for not doing his job. And so someone must have gotten to Trump to tell him to back off attacking Cuomo, because it'll just backfire. Because Cuomo is the president of New York right now, and there are plenty of people who would like him to be president of the United States at this moment because of the way he's handling this crisis. We can say whatever we want about this man, about being a control freak and all the rest of it, but you know what? He's our control freak, and I will take him anytime over what we have in Washington, because he's doing a great job.
Yeah, and it's so interesting to watch the dynamic that Alan was talking about earlier. Jim Handler.
So, Joe, just so you know, I'm not able to hear Alan. I can hear everyone else.
I got to talk louder.
Well, that's not good.
Well, at least I won't be disagreeing with him too much today.
Our cracked engineering staff will take care of that.
They're already on it. But go ahead, Jim. I ask you the question of what I was reading to you earlier from the Washington Post. Your response to that.
Well, you know, I think the excuse me. I think the key thing we're seeing is the need for leadership. And you can see even at the national level, the people who are trying to make things work are working very hard. When you look at, you know, Fauci at the news conference and things like that, you can see that there are people who really are fighting with the president's worst instincts to get things to happen. And I don't know if he's listening to them that or not, but sometimes he seems to. But it seems like he's got two strategies. One is what he says in public at his news briefings, and the other is what he says to his base on Twitter. And it's, you know, really annoying in a sense having two presidents at this point. So I like Libby's concept that, you know, Cuomo right now is our president, and that's what people are looking for, is clear leadership, you know, easy to understand what's going on in a complicated time. And unfortunately, that's not what we're seeing most of the time from the White House.
Jim Ketterer.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all that has just been said. And I would also add that in addition to leadership, which, of course, is essential, you need all the other things that allow you to do the blocking and tackling of governance amidst a crisis situation. You need processes. You need people in the right place. You need people who are trained, who have done all the exercises before. In New York, you know, the people in emergency management, were through 9/11, through hurricanes, through massive other issues, and those things are in place. And it appears that on the federal level, for the last 3 years, there has been a consistent attempt to not support those offices, not listen to the expertise, to defund offices, to not appoint people to key positions. And I can remember being on the round table at several other times in the past when I would say, this is already dangerous enough to see what goes on, but what's going to happen if we have a real crisis?
Right.
And now we do, and unfortunately now we see.
I'm just going to pause you there because we have to take a break, but that's such a good point. And I know we were all saying that, of wondering what would happen, and now we're finding out. We'll delve into that a little bit more. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. It's the Roundtable panel on this March 23rd, a Monday, and we welcome you to our program panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We welcome your letters, certainly. Let's just get back real quick to let Jim finish his thoughts. We were talking right before the break about how Jim and many others were saying, you know, how would this president respond in a true world or even national emergency, and we're starting to find out. I guess the question a lot of people are asking about this president is, you know, can you learn that? Do you think you'll get it eventually?
Well, I guess we have no choice but to hope that that's the case. and to a certain extent, every president amidst a crisis like this has to learn on the job. I mean, some of these things are hard to do, but you shouldn't have to be doing that without, as I said before, all of the kind of structures, processes, people in place, the kind of, you know, permanent part of the government that's ready to respond and knows how to do it and has the experience of doing it. And then you have to listen to them. I mean, the report in the Washington Post, I think it was, that said that the intelligence agencies, you know, had the red light blinking about this and it wasn't paid attention to. Et cetera. The removal of the National Security Council office that would have been the point on this, and on and on. This is not a good time for lots of new people to be learning on the job.
You know, Joe, my hope is that if the Democrats have a single brain in their heads, which sometimes I worry about, they are preparing. And the Biden people, they are preparing, you know, a promo which basically shows an ad which basically shows the president saying the whole thing is a Democratic hoax, and that they play it over and over and over again. Seems to me that that is really the crux of all of this, because while Well, the president has some people working for him who are very good. We know that, Fauci and others. The fact is that they're not enough and that he does send out contrary messages because the one thing he's really concerned about is getting reelected. So he's got to keep feeding that monster, that base, no matter what he agrees with Cuomo or anybody else.
Jim Handler.
You know, I've just been thinking in my head what some of the commercials could be, the TV commercials could be from the Democrats. And it's not pretty, but I can say, there's just a couple of lines that Trump has said, one of which is, I take no responsibility, you know, and then you just have images of cemeteries, you know, and the numbers of how many people have died. And just using that over and over and over again, and there are some other choice things that he has said as well. And, you know, he's signing his own defeat notice, is the best way of putting it, rather than death certificate. But he's signing his own, death certificate for his reelection because of his rhetoric and because of the lack of leadership. You know, Jim is both James and Jim and Alan are absolutely right. We've all been saying this. Leadership is key here, and that's what we want. That's what we look for. That's what we crave, actually, in times like these, for the people that we've elected to be at the top spots to actually rise to the occasion. And Trump does not have that ability. He doesn't have any sense of empathy or ability to see the suffering of other people. So he cannot be a leader.
Yes, with all that said, though.
Press conferences, it's all about I.
Yes, it's true.
Never about
yes.
We.
Yes, but on the other hand, we at WAMC would never. And you know that, and I just think that that's the way it came out. We would never hope for the death of the president, period.
I'm talking about his campaign and his reelection prospects. Sure. Right, absolutely.
Jim Handler.
So, you know, there's a campaign ad running, unfortunately not getting nearly as much airtime as it deserves, which is a split screen with Trump making ridiculous comments about the coronavirus, and then Biden making, you know, smart moves. And the tagline of it is, you know, in times of crisis, we need a president. And then it says, in November, you can elect one. So thought that was, you know, really sums up a lot of my thinking about it, that, you know, we need someone in charge of this government who's going to be able to run not just whatever's still going on by then, but the recovery that's going to be going on for years. And you know, scares me to death what happens with someone who's only thinking about themselves in the White House.
I want to go to letters. We have many and get to as many as we can here. We have a break coming up in just a few minutes, but we'll get to more. Many, and then we'll continue when we come back. Sheldon writes, President Trump has repeatedly trumpeted the fact that he had inherited an obsolete bad system for dealing with pandemics. Giving him this untrue fact, how come then in 3 years plus he did not correct it and make it the best in the world? Why has no reporter dared to ask the question? Anyone?
Well, I don't know that. I don't know that nobody has ever asked the question or anything like it, to be honest with you. And I don't think our letter writer is watching every moment, you know, of this. The fact of the matter is, the guy is despicable. He's just despicable because he converts truth into any kind of lie that he wants and says it over and over again. Goebbels talked about it. It's known as the big lie. You just keep saying it over and over again. The fact is, there was a pandemic office and he got rid of it. I didn't know about that. Tough noogies. You don't know about it? Well, that's your problem because you're the president, you're the leader, and you're the one we hold accountable.
Right. We got this from Wendy who said, I apologize. This one is from Roger who says, I know Alan is sounding the alarm bell about increased gun and ammunition sales. Please try to understand that folks want the ability to protect themselves and their families in these trying times. Thank God our Constitution trusts the citizenry to give them that right. All you need to do is look at the announcement over the weekend from the Philly Police Department that they will not be arresting criminals for a long list of felonies, including violent felonies. The environment with businesses closed and violent criminals being released certainly gives people concern for their safety. I have to fact check that from the Philly Police Department, but does anyone want to talk about the...
I certainly would, since I was named.
Absolutely.
Yes, I certainly think that there are too many guns out there. We know that. There are a couple of guns for every American, something like that. We go back to times when a perfectly innocent guy runs out of gas in a, or his car gets waylaid, or he walks up and knocks on a door and somebody pulls out a gun and kills him. You're going to see more of that, folks. This is going to be what I'm worried about. I think we have too many guns. I think Roger is dead wrong about this. You know, the idea that it's going... I remember Archie Bunker when the thief came in and stole his gun. And that was quite an episode, and it made a great point. I think that this idea of this run on guns is very, very dangerous.
Meanwhile, I did check the...
Me too.
Check Philadelphia. That is not what the police department said. They have been instructed to stop making arrests for certain nonviolent crimes because the courts are closed and because of the arrests and the concern of putting people into even their local jails. The police commissioner stressed Wednesday that the temporary police does not mean the department is turning a blind eye to crime. The department said individuals who would normally be arrested and processed at a detective division will be temporarily detained to confirm identification and complete necessary paperwork. The individual will then be arrested on a warrant at a later date.
Thank God for your fact-checking, Joe. And please, Roger and others who would write us letters with misinformation, and cut it out.
Yes. All right. Let's go to this letter from Richard, who says, with all the troubling news, there's one piece of news I don't hear reported enough. In very early February, my son-in-law, Army Sergeant, received what he called DOD, which is an email notification from the Department of Defense. In it, he was alerted to prepared for domestic emergency reposting due to an evolving medical situation. This was a month and a half ago. I have heard that from other people. So I guess that goes against what the president was saying early on, right?
Which is what? Oh yeah, a month and a half ago.
Yeah, a month and a half ago.
But we ought to at least recognize that troops are being moved in different places. So they knew it, and they knew it was going to be important. Cuomo has certainly not been shy about that. So it's what needed to be done.
We go. Continuing with the letters to Kevin, credibility is everything, he says, and Trump has none, not a good trait when a pandemic hits. Then Maureen says, how is it that this senator, Rand Paul, was tested when he had no symptoms? Were they all tested? Do we know that? Anybody know the answer to that question?
So Rand Paul...
Well, they've got better health care than
Rand
all
Paul's
of
people
well, you
said,
know how that is.
All right, let's go to Jim. Go ahead.
Rand Paul's people said that in an abundance of caution, he decided to take the test.
Was that
because he was asymptomatic?
Before or after he also then went swimming in the Senate pool?
Well, and also shook hands with everybody at a breakfast and several other things. But since he didn't really believe it, you know, there's a certain karma in this because, you know, sort of holding up the major bill for a while. Well, we did have agreement, and now it's back to splitting up again. I must say, this is one where I wish everybody in Congress would just say, let's figure out the parts we agree on, move that out, and then get the parts we argue about into a separate bill, because this is crazy. And, you know, I'm not sure, but you sure like to see something happening on the national level. If it's not coming out of the president, it's got to come out of Congress.
Well, that's what McCain.
Jump in
that's
on
what,
this yeah, sure. for a second, too. And, you know, I think we need to, and I hope somebody is doing it, we need to be thinking long and hard through the scenarios in which a substantial number, or at least enough of a number, of our political leadership are quarantined or sick or unable to come to Congress, unable to vote. Several have self-quarantined after the Rand Paul announcement. What if, you know, Angela Merkel is now quarantined, et cetera? If you multiply this over and over and over again, we really need to think about when we need people to take quick, decisive, important actions. If we just don't have people available, how does that play out? What's plan B?
Well, first of all, look at what we're doing. We're all communicating right now. I don't think that in this kind of circumstance you can't come up with an apparatus that works on this. I think that these people aren't dead. They're sitting in their houses. So that's what phones are for. That's what telecommunications is all about. But the other thing is, I suspect that this president may be waiting for this to happen. I mean, one of the scariest points about all of this, and I think Joe Biden has made this point, is that we voted during World War II, we voted during the Civil War, or we should be voting now. There are an awful lot of people who think that this president is just ready to jump with that kind of thinking, which is, I'll take charge and that'll be it. And that's how you get dictatorship.
I agree with you, Alan. I do think he's looking at this as an opportunity to suspend the elections, which would cause a major constitutional crisis in the country. And I think you would literally have millions in the streets and blood in the streets as well. I don't think people would stand for it.
We're going to take a break there on that happy note. And take a break. We'll come back. And we have many more letters. We'll get to those. It's our panel on the roundtable this morning. Libby Post, James Ketterer, Jim Hendler, and Alan Chartok. We will be back right after this. 49 minutes past 9 o'clock. You're listening to the roundtable panel on this Monday, the 23rd of March. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Going to go back to the letters for a few moments. This one from Diana. Please talk with a hospital nurse in any New York City hospital. Healthcare workers in New York City are being told they will get one disposable mask a shift. Nurses and MDs and housekeeping staff and others are terrified and overwhelmed. Do not believe Trump or his cronies when they say the personal protective equipment, PPE, is coming. Well, when? Healthcare workers will get infected, become ill, be quarantined, or die. Who will be there to care for you? And this is really what I started with at the beginning of the great concern that is being spoken by the governors, especially those on the front lines. I mentioned Governor Cuomo, of course, Governor of Washington, Governor of California, and many others, even Governor of Illinois, who say that they're simply not being, they don't have enough supplies. The president, in speaking yesterday, gave a long list of numbers, but it doesn't seem to be landing. That equipment does not seem to be landing. It doesn't seem to be enough. And to Diana's point in her letter, how does, well, not only New York, but how do all of these hospitals and facilities, how are they able to do their jobs if they don't have the basic equipment they need? Alan, what do you think?
Well, look, this guy keeps giving misinformation. The vice president keeps talking about what a terrific job his president is doing. He knows that if he makes a misstep, he's not going to be the vice presidential candidate for very long. I think the real hero in this becomes Fauci, because he is indicating more and more that he just doesn't agree with the kind of garbage that is being given out here. He's been honest and straightforward right from the beginning. But you got a guy who fires everybody who disagrees with him, you got into a lot of trouble.
Jim, I'm interested, Jim Ketterer, I'm interested in your expertise in this as far as is working in the global community like you have over so long, of how you get, I mean, certainly we have dealt with trying to get much needed supplies to places in a short period of time all over the world. So how do you do it in this country where you would think that would not be as big of an issue as it has become?
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. military is excellent at many things, and one of them is logistics, is moving lots of stuff, big things, quickly and in a coordinated way. And so I think that sounds to me that that's what the governors are calling for, this kind of assistance coming from the federal government to the state level. But I also think, you know, and of course we need to focus on what's going on here, but the very nature of this pandemic is that it's global as well. And so we can't completely take our eye off of the global situation and think, well, if we just mitigate it here, then we're out of the woods. If we see not only the massive spread of the pandemic and other corners of the globe, but then all the other sorts of things that you all were just talking about, you know, kind of the breakdown of law and order, of people in the streets, of this, that, and the other thing, all of which is highly likely in places that are going to, you know, really take the brunt of this pandemic, that will affect us. We can't wall ourselves off from that. So we're going to have to think through how we take care of things here at home, but also how we address these things internationally at the same time. It's an unbelievable challenge. But, to your question, I mean, the military is great at this function.
We go to Billy, who writes, go ahead, Jim.
I was just going to say, one of the things, though, that a lot of people are asking is, so one of the authorities that the president does have is what's called the Defense Production Act. I recommend people Wikipedia it if they want a good, easy to understand discussion. But it allows the president to require businesses to create contracts for the things we need. It can prohibit wording and price gouging. And for some reason, you know, that's not being used. And this is something that could really be used, not just to create the supplies here, but, you know, eventually a surplus when we don't need them that would go elsewhere.
So what's your guess as to why he's not using that? I mean, I've been scratching my head. Is it that he's so deeply in bed with these corporations, or that it runs counter to his philosophy? What do you think?
My guess is twofold. One is you've got the small government people who don't want it done. And then I think what you said, it's kind of runs counter to his way of doing things.
Well, I also think, I mean, in today or yesterday, because the articles we wrote this morning, he likened it to, well, just ask, you know, the people in Venezuela how they like businesses being nationalized, which shows that he has no clue what he's talking about, because that's not what we're talking about here. We're not talking about taking over the industry. We're talking about getting them to do what they need to do like they did in World War II. And that's what part of the reason why we were able to rebuild our economy, but also win the war. And so, I think he should be doing this, but I think he's waiting to see which companies will do it. I mean, this is a little cynical, so that he can tip off his friends and they can all invest in those companies, because they know their shares will, the value of those companies will increase if they're doing business with the government and getting a lot of money from the government making profits. So it's a very cynical perspective on this from an investor point of view, and how he just caters to the investor class, but also that he really doesn't understand what it means, what this act does, because it's not about nationalizing the oil companies like they did in Venezuela. This is about conscripting the companies to do this work, and they're going to get paid for it. Nobody's going to be taking their profits and putting it into somebody's, you know, back into government. They're going to get paid. So let's be real about this. It's just, he doesn't know what he's doing. I mean, that's really the bottom line. He just doesn't. He's incompetent, and he doesn't know what he's doing.
Just when, because you mentioned the stock market, we'll note that the stock market right now is somewhere around down 230, bouncing around in that territory, but down this morning as it was. We got the futures yesterday that certainly indicated that. I want to ask this question from Billy and have Alan and then Libby take a turn at it. Billy asks, does Alan truly think that devising negative political ads is the best use of the Dems' time right now? This health crisis and its resolution should be the focus, uniting our community, not dividing. There will be plenty of time for review and criticism after we get all through as one country in solidarity. I think Billy's question is an important one. There was a ideological conversation or a debate between two former Obama staffers, David Axelrod and David Plouffe, one the campaign manager, one the senior advisor to the president. David Axelrod saying pretty much what Billy was saying. Look, now's the time to get the country united and not a time to go negative. And David Plouffe saying, no, now is absolutely the time to go negative. Now is the time to make the to show the differences. And Alan, so with that, what do you make of it?
Well, I have no doubt about it. Trump is a bully. Trump says crazy things. He says anything he wants to say, and nobody calls him on. Well, people call him on it, but it's tiny voices in the wilderness.
But should the Democrats be running negative ads on that now?
They absolutely should. They should say this guy had the chutzpah, the nerve, to say this whole thing was a hoax. And now he says he's 100% and he gets 10 out of 10. Come on, folks. What planet are you living on? Plouffe is right. Axelrod, who I have great respect for, is wrong. And by the way, it doesn't mean you can't do both.
Yes.
You can try to unite people.
That's right.
So let's go from the political scientist to the political consultant with the note that the political consultant was a student of the political scientist. Go ahead.
And hasn't listened to one damn thing I've said ever.
Oh, that's not true, Alan. You know, I say you made me what I am today. I think that there's a way of spinning this both positive and negative. Because you can run ads, like I've said before, with the cemeteries and the death toll, and I didn't take any responsibility, and it's a hoax. That was the other thing that he said. And then you can also run ads talking about Democratic leadership. And Joe Biden, he was in the administration when we dealt with the Ebola crisis. This is Trump Ebola. That's what this is. This is Trump's Ebola, and he has fallen down. And so you can show both sides of this and show what true leadership looks like, you know, and that will bring people together, and the negatives will also bring people together. You know, it's a combination of both, because I guarantee it, that there will be negative ads from the RNC, from Trump, attacking Joe Biden on Ebola. I guarantee it.
We've got to come
out with all guns blaring on this.
We have just about a minute before we have to go to a break, but do either of the Jims have a differing point of view?
Okay, this is Jim Ketterer. I differ a bit only in that in the day-to-day, you know, we're still really, maybe even still in the early days of the worst of this, and we still need to do the blocking and tackling of governance in the midst of a horrible crisis. This is hitting the U.S. far more than Ebola did. That's a terrible disease. But, you know, I look to Anthony Fauci as a model. He has to work with Trump. He has to find a way to make this work. We've got to get through this. This is truly a catastrophe. And the politics will play out. But we're going to have to get through these next weeks as well as we can. And that's not going to be easy.
Well, a great first hour, and I thank you all for your participation in the panel this morning. We're going to come back and have dig into our second hour. We welcome you, of course, the listener, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll return with Alan Chartok, Libby Post, James Ketterer, and Jim Henler next. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We have many, many letters, and I'm going to try to get to as many as possible. Just a quick programming note. The governor of New York State, Andrew Cuomo, is expected to be giving an update on the New York State response to coronavirus at 10:45 this morning from the Red Room at the Capitol. We will go to that as soon as it happens. Also, the President of the United States and the White House Task Force on Coronavirus will be giving an update at 5:30, now scheduled for 5:30 this afternoon, and we will go to that when it comes later on today. We have, as I mentioned, many, many letters, and I'm going to try to roll through as many as I can. And panel, just stop me if you want to comment on any of these things. Some are just statements, others are letters, but I'll go through them from bottom to top. Here we go. Kim says, as an RN facing COVID-19 on a daily basis, I'm infuriated that the POTUS has not enacted the Defense Protection Act. Where I live in the Capital District, we have not even experienced a surge into our hospital, and we are already expected to wear a disposable mask for many days in a row. This is simply unacceptable. The government should be doing everything possible to help protect us so that we can care for others, including getting more equipment made using every possible resource at hand. Does anyone know the state of the Defense Protection Act, which I thought the president said he had enacted, but I don't know that it has. Do we know the answer to that question?
So as I understand it, there are three clauses of the act, two which are more forceful that really let him command things to happen. One which basically just uses a contracting authority. So it basically says the way the government buy things can be used to buy peacetime things as well. So that one is the one that tends to help military businesses and things like that. My understanding is he's using that clause, but not yet the other clauses, which are the ones that could really help solve these problems.
Let's go to other letters, and this one from Gus, who says, my brother lives and breathes Fox News in New York City. He asked to come and help with my house. I asked him if he was aware of the governor's orders to stay in place. He said he didn't have the virus. He was sure of it. The arrogance of what Fox News gives to its viewers is almost criminal. This is a really big problem. We then go to Mark and Jill, who say the mixed messages that Trump has been sending over coronavirus is exemplified by the visual images of his own daily press conferences where we see officials standing shoulder to shoulder. Why are they not practicing social distancing? Look at how Cuomo and his aides are sitting 6 feet apart at his press conferences. Certainly many people on Twitter are going nuts over that with good reason. This from Patricia, who says, thanks to Libby for her comment about Governor Cuomo and his presidential leadership qualities. She's right on target. He's a perfect example of a real leader, sets aside politics and party biases and strikes at the heart of the real crisis and figures out exactly what and how to do it. He has empathy and concern for others, but not in a false way, just wants to get it done and move forward. Cuomo for president, go Andrew, says Patricia.
Let me check in on that one. Joe,
yes, Alan.
Because I think it's very interesting. For anybody to think that Governor Cuomo doesn't understand politics or isn't playing politics is just wrong. Of course he knows it. He happens to be absolutely right in what he's saying and what he's doing. He's going in that direction. And as far as I'm concerned, you have to understand he's a political animal and he knows what he's doing, but he's right. And so this isn't laying aside politics. It's brilliant.
We go to John, who says, I was chatting with some family members this weekend about Governor Cuomo's handling of the COVID-19 crisis. I almost said that I was impressed or proud, but caught myself, then said this. You know, I'd forgotten what real responsibility from elected officials looked like. It's refreshing to see it again in the U.S. Sad that it has become so rare. Then Lucy says, when Trump said he was, quote unquote, honored by Americans' response to the crisis as if we were doing this to honor him. Holy crap, says Lucy. Kurt says, is it me or is Trump totally losing it? Losing what little was there? He seems even more incoherent than ever. No complete sentences, no sense at all. Why can't one of the pandemic team step up and correct him? Well, easier said than done, I think, but okay.
Fauci was asked about that, and he made it quite clear. He couldn't. He just couldn't. There were limits.
Don says the Iroquois in New York and their great law of peace say that the necessary prerequisite for leadership is to have a skin 7 spans thick and a heart for the people. Need I say more in the current circumstances? John says that great take two. John says that great philosopher George Carlin used to say, save the earth? No, save yourselves. The earth will shake us off like a bad habit. If we continue to insist on living incompatibly with the values of this planet, the virus will only be the beginning of that process. Benjamin writes, good morning and thank you for reading my comment. There is so much negativity going on during these times, and it is easy to point blame, especially to the current President of the United States. But instead of fueling the increasing divisions in our country, don't you think it's time to promote unity? I wouldn't say I'm a Trump supporter, but Alan and the panel have been very aggressive towards him, more hurt than help with the negativity. We need to be united. This is all in capital letters, so you know. We need to be united. Stop promoting political differences. Think of the young people who are trying to be informed here. What message are we sending them? And I think this is very similar to the point we were talking about right before the break of whether you go negative or whether you try to unite the country.
I think you have to keep this president and hold him responsible. This letter is clearly a letter that, you know, lets Trump off the hook. Let's all play nicely. He hits, everybody else runs for cover. Come on now, folks. We know better than this.
Nancy writes, has anyone heard from Vice President Biden lately? There are a lot of rumors on Twitter that he's sick or worse. I'm assuming it's just more misinformation, but just wondering if you had anything on this. I think he was, I saw a press conference with him yesterday, and he seems fine, but it does bring us to an item that we're going to discuss this morning, which is, you know, how do you run a campaign? How do you be relevant when you can't be out barnstorming the country? You can't. Many of the primaries are on hold. You're not going from town to town and make a difference to break through in this news cycle. Alan?
Well, the big issue on this one clearly is whether or not Biden is saying or suggesting, when he talks about the vice presidency, that we have to have a strong vice president because ... He gave a remarkable interview to some donors the other day that I think was quite dangerous. If he's not ill, he has to present himself. He wanted this job as being vigorous and being healthy and being willing to move forward. But when he started talking about the vice presidential nominee and how important it was that you get somebody who really could take over at any moment, I had some chills.
Libby?
Well, at the beginning he was strong, then he faltered, then he came back, and now people are seeing it falter again. I don't know if it's lowering expectations. I think his talk about a strong vice president, you know, isn't necessarily a reflection of where he's at physically or mentally, but also a reflection of reality in terms of we are in a contest now to elect the oldest presidents of the United States ever. And so, you know, I think it's more about finding a vice president who in 4 years can run and can win, and somebody who can be the Joe Biden, be the vice president Joe Biden was to Obama.
You know, I absolutely agree with you, Libby, I absolutely agree with you. But this is not a time to be talking philosophically. This is a time to say, I can do this job.
Right. No, I agree with you, Alan. We need to see strong Joe, and we need to see strong Joe for the rest of the campaign. Vital, putting everything in one place, being the leader that we want. He needs to now be the leader that America craves, and that we do not presently have in the White House.
So I agree with
both. A draft at the convention, and Cuomo might end up being the nominee. You never know.
I think we know.
But it is an interesting question. So many people are talking about Cuomo for president that it must occur to these guys. It must occur to these guys that maybe the right thing to do is to, nominate him to be vice president. But the problem, of course, and you know what it is that he's already sworn that he's going to have a woman.
That he's what?
That he's going to have a woman.
He's going to have a woman. But, right. Yeah. Right. Right. Right.
So my feeling on this is that...
Okay, let's go to James and then Jim. James, go ahead.
Okay. We have the Surgeon General now coming out and saying that this week is going to be much worse than the preceding weeks. On this question of, going negative or not going negative, or, what does Joe Biden say about vice president or not, I hope that I'm wrong. But if the people like the Surgeon General are right, I think generally Americans are going to be focused on the immediacy of a horrible crisis. And we need to hold everybody accountable who has not behaved properly in this. but we're still in the midst of this, and it's not going to get better immediately, according to the experts. And I think some of these issues about who Biden's VP candidate is going to be, though they're interesting to us, are not going to be on people's minds.
Jim Hendler.
You know, I think that Biden's in a very tough place, because to get news coverage, he would have to do exactly the kind of things that Libby and Alan are talking about. And yet my belief is that his heart is closer to what James was just saying, which is, you know, this is a time for unification. This is not a time to be feisty and doing it. And so, you know, I worry in some ways that the good things about him are at war with what we need in a presidential nominee at this point. And, you know, I'm not sure what's the right answer in that case, but I think it's worth noting that just getting media attention for him right now is going to be very difficult unless he does, I don't even know what word to say, strident things. And that's just not his style in a crisis. It's to fix things.
And we have many other things to discuss, but I'll ask the question because I know it's something that the Biden people have brought up, which is that would be made easier if Bernie was out of the race.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Well, if Bernie gets out of the race,
I want to add.
Shut up. A lot of mumbling. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Libby.
If Bernie gets out of the race, it doesn't mean that Bernie's going to shut up.
Well, right, but so, as far as if it was a united front of the Democrats, that Biden would have a little more freedom to be able to go out and have that united front of the party.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, let's go to letters. We have about 10 minutes before a break, and we'll roll through some here. Debbie says, at a recent press briefing, the president complained about masks being thrown away after use. Would someone please enlighten him about viral transmission? Then we go to Casey, who says, making stuff up, Washington Post, Trump did not get rid of the pandemic office because of one track agenda roundtable missing one of the biggest stories. The sense of unity against the epidemic being forged across America. Polls reflect that Trump is mobilizing an enormous national response, both private and public, joining the media and trying to drive a wedge between Trump and Fauci. You think that is helpful? Question mark, and that is with a subject line, fact checking.
I wish I could live in that America.
Mm-hmm.
Virginia writes, don't
I, can I just say that what that letter writer is talking about is that office supposedly was moved somewhere else and absorbed into some other existing operation. The whole point of having that office at the National Security Council, at the White House, at the point, you know, where you're setting up policy processes that then funnel into this decision-making process, and you've got the right people at the decision point in the White House, that's crucial. And so, you know, the letter writer may argue the facts, but without knowing the details and why that was important, why that decision was important, and I would say it was the wrong decision. But you have to understand how government works, why it works, and why we set up the structures and processes that we do.
Virginia writes, don't change horses in the middle of the stream. Increasingly, Trump and his administration are using the word war whenever they can. Trump is setting himself up to be a war president and scaring everyone into voting for him in the fall. There is quite an article about just that subject in this morning's New York Times. Ed writes a letter with the subject heading of dismantling of pandemic response team. Let's be very clear. The buck always stops with the president, any president, but it was John Bolton in the spring of 2018 who dismantled the team in charge of the pandemic response. The same John Bolton who was recently described by a lot of people, including a hero of mine on the panel, with words like very bright, capable, smart administrator, and brilliant elder statesman. Elaine says, I think Dr. Fauci quickly gained our confidence with his plain, honest explanations. But yesterday when I listened to him by radio, I was disappointed. My feeling during his responses was that his message wasn't as clear. He used more butt-kissing speech and less plain, concise language. Not surprising, I guess, since 45 doesn't like to share the spotlight. Did anyone else notice this? Well, I did notice that for 2 days last week he wasn't on the panel at all, which is interesting. Rick says operating rooms and equipment get sterilized and reused, so why can't the same thing be done with masks? We go to Norman, who says Trump told us why he is not pushing for increased production of medical supplies, particularly test kits, when he said that he didn't want the passengers on the cruise ship off San Francisco to land because it will, quote, increase the numbers of infected people, i.e., let's suppress the numbers. Ellen says, do you think that this pandemic will pave the way for universal health care just as the Great Depression paved the way for Social Security? Well, we are hearing about the Affordable Care Act, aren't we? About interest in expanding that for people who are affected by this virus. Alan?
Well, you know, frankly, I haven't heard that. Nevertheless, you know, it makes a great deal of sense that if people aren't covered right now, that there has to be a way to cover them. And I think that the imperative there is shared by the American people. So what's more interesting is not that people are saying it should be extended, but that Trump isn't fighting that rhetoric.
Let's go to... Yeah, there was a an article. I'm trying to find it real quick on the fly here, but there was an article. Seems the Trump. There was an article that came out on the 22nd, which was yesterday, that said that ACA enrollment may reopen in the wake of the coronavirus COVID-19 pandemic. So that is something that is being considered.
Must have missed that one. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. We'll go to the listeners. Barbara says the less Biden says, the better. He's got it. Okay.
I think there's a point there, but I do think he has to, Joe, I think he has to show himself, and I think he has to be firm and strong and say what's wrong with this president. I mean, after all, that's why we're having a presidential election. This business about from the Trumpers or the neo-Trumpers who are saying, oh, come on now, folks, we all need to be together now, basically creates a pro-Trump approach.
So I've been reading the letters where people are taking us to task for being too hard on the president, and Brian is piling on and saying, you are... look, you are not nearly negative enough about the incompetence of this president. So we're getting that, too.
Thanks for that, Brian.
Ellen says...
I'm sure we could do better.
All we have to do is try.
That's right. Zachary says, ask these questions about the federal election and Trump. What government branch can legally postpone and cancel the November election? That's question one. Question two, can Trump hijack the second term using the pandemic, and can he succeed in it? Two very different questions there.
Yes, well, let me just say no, he can't succeed.
All right.
Well, let me just try the other side, Libby, for the heck of it. The American people don't go out with pots and pans onto the streets. We know that because they would have been out a long time ago yelling and screaming about the ineptitude about this guy. But they don't do that, and the scariness of him. So I'm concerned that if he says it now, these elections are state elections. There's no question about it. The state sets the rules. The state does this thing. But I think if he thinks he can get away with it, he will try.
And we go to another Alan for this letter. I'm so grateful to Senator Sanders for coming out and speaking on almost a daily basis about the coronavirus pandemic. He has become the de facto leader of the party and a calming, sure voice in these troubled times. If Biden wants to take over the mantle, he needs to do the same. It's not Sanders' job to coddle and make excuses for someone who wants to be president of the United States.
Let me try to respond to that. I disagree.
That's a good response. I like that. That's a good response. Anyone else on that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the problems that Biden faces, Sanders is doing this as a senator. He can command that time. He can talk about what's going on in Congress. Biden is not an acting vice president. He's not someplace where he can hold a daily news conference and you know, get the press. He can get the press, but he won't get the kind of coverage. And he doesn't have the kind of clout right now to be saying, I'm doing something. I think he's in a tough position. I do now think he needs to speak up.
Now, you know how much respect I have for you. Nevertheless,
here it comes, Jim.
Yeah, oh, it's right.
If Biden walks out, can I go back to where I couldn't hear him?
If Biden walks outside and says, "Okay, press, I'm going to give a very tough statement about the president's actions and what he's doing," or anything he wants to say, he'll get all the press he wants. Being silent is not the right way to proceed right now.
I don't know why, and Libby, I'll ask you this question, but if you're the Biden campaign, why isn't he on every Sunday show? Why, even if he's doing it by Skype, why isn't he on Face the Nation? Why isn't he on the Today Show and Good Morning America? Why isn't he just blasting it? Because you know if they called up and said he wanted to be on, he'd be on.
And you
I don't know why.
Yeah. And you know people will make whatever they can about it, and they'll say, well, he's sick, and that's why he's doing this. And the people, the scurrilous rumor makers, and you know that it'll happen. He's got to get out there.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying. I just don't understand why you wouldn't do it. I mean, it seems so easy. At this time, it's not like people are forcing him off. Any producer in the world, if Joe Biden called up and said, I want to be on, would be on.
You know, this isn't the Republican running against Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who says we're in the middle of a world war. This is a whole other issue. This is a matter of incompetence by the way a domestic crisis is being handled. If he thinks, if Biden thinks that it will go against him, it'll go against him to open his mouth, he's making a sad mistake.
We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. Quick programming note. We are waiting for New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. He is expected to begin speaking around 10:45 this morning and give an update on the state's response to coronavirus. We will be covering that live coming up this morning. That in just a few moments. I do want to get to a topic in the 10 minutes or so that we have left, and then I'll go back to the few letters that we have here. There was an interesting article about supercomputing and what is being done with IBM and the White House to deploy supercomputers to fight coronavirus. Not surprisingly, our own Jim Hendler is a part of this effort. And because it is national news, Wall Street Journal had a big piece about it as well. Jim, give us a sense of what's going on and how this can help the effort.
Sure. This is a, you know, an example of people stepping up to try to see what we can do to help. So Rensselaer has one of the most powerful supercomputers at any university in America. IBM has provided some top supercomputers to the Department of Energy and to others. And then, of course, you have big companies like Google and Amazon that have these huge computers. And one of the technologies in the modern toolkit is the artificial intelligence technology we've mentioned on the show from time to time. And things like molecular modeling, trying to figure out which kind of responses work based on big data, trying to understand all the papers that are being published about this. All of that stuff requires just an amazing amount of computing power. So a number of organizations, including Rensselaer, have gotten together and said, you know, we will make our computers available for free, and that's a high cost to us, but we will let people who have good ideas use this computation. So there is now a website that the government has set up with IBM's help where people can actually say, I propose to do the following kind of research and I need powerful computing. The combined computation of all of these machines makes it, you know, the combined machine is essentially the most powerful computer in the entire world now, and it will be devoted very heavily to trying to do things to help us develop vaccines and find good responses to this virus.
So who oversees that system, Jim? Like, who makes the decisions of who gets on and who doesn't?
So the primary focus is coming out of the Office of Science and Technology Policy, the current president's advisor is actually somebody with a strong background in supercomputing, which helps. IBM is putting in a lot of the resources, so they're doing the coordination. And then there's a team of us, one from each organization, who will actually be judging these proposals to figure out, you know, how to do it. And then there's a sort of technical infrastructure that's being maintained by another group of people to make sure that the computers are being used appropriately, that the computation can go to the most appropriate place to run it, and things like that.
So two follow-up questions. One, what is the timeline? When you say judging, it seems to me like it could take a while. But if you have an idea, how long could it, the fastest that it could get through so you could start work on it?
We're trying to get it down to days at this point, and hopefully hours eventually.
And if all
we have a, you know, again, this is, we're not asking for big, long, complex proposals. They're fairly simple, and they say, this is what we want to do, and here's what resources we need, and here's why we can do it.
And as far as the best case scenario, what will come out of this that would affect us?
Best case scenario is two things. One is molecular modeling. So we kind of know what the virus looks like, as you've seen all those pictures of it, but how that causes the problems it causes is just beginning to be understood, and what to do about that, what kind of vaccine you could create, requires modeling many, many, many possible ways of attacking it. With these kind of supercomputers, we can model many of them at the same time over time and try literally hundreds of millions of possibilities out to find what are the most promising. So that's one. And then the other is really just trying to figure out public responses. So this is a big data problem. We've heard that term a lot, and these are the machines that know how to handle big data. So we're really hoping that that's going to make this possible.
Well, that's very, very cool, and very cool that you're a part of it and sharing it with us. I want to go back to the letters again. We're waiting for the governor to speak in just about 5 minutes, so we'll try to get to as many letters as we can, assuming he's on time, and if not, we'll keep going until he starts. We go to Robert's letter, who said, so imagine you're the lead surgeon in an operating room and some incompetent and unhygienic administrator is just grabbing your scalpels and spewing racist remarks while you're trying to perform on your patient. That's what life is like for Dr. Anthony Fauci these days. Dr. Fauci is a real patriot. Here he is trying to manage our nation's response to a pandemic while also having to manage Trump's ego and lies in order to keep us alive.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's exactly right. Yep. And so the problem the guy has is, would I rather be here doing what I'm doing or not here? Because I know if I go one step too far, I'm gone.
That's right. That's the old.
And if he's gone, we're all gone.
Exactly. Well, we need
no one else. Right. Yeah. There's no one else with the, with his skills and intelligence and background. He oversaw the greatest, solving of the AIDS crisis back in the 90s. I mean, he really knows his stuff. And if he's gone, I mean, if he leaves, it opens him, it gives him the ability to speak more freely about this. But it will also open him up to attacks by Trump.
Think of all the people who've been fired, all the militarists, all the military people. Sorry, wrong word. Who were there?
Oh, I know.
They come on Meet the Press every once in a while. It means almost nothing. You got to be in a seat of power.
I think it's okay for me to say this because I'm going to be quoting President Lyndon Baines Johnson, who said that it was better to be on the inside pissing out than to be on the outside pissing in.
Yes, than the outside pissing in.
Right.
Absolutely.
So, certainly the case there. Let's go to Barbara, who said, I listen to your intelligent insights every morning. Thank you. Regarding negative press for Trump, telling the truth is not negative press. It is objective journalism. How have we arrived at a moment when lies and self-aggrandizement are given press time, but speaking the truth of the matter is considered negative?
I want to respond.
Yes.
I want to respond to that. God bless you, Barbara.
A very good response. Brian says, please discuss need to know. Last week, the first bill, the Families First Coronavirus Act, which provided 7B to the state as well as extending unemployment benefits. Is that $7 billion, I assume? Is that what he means? Currently, New York doesn't qualify for it because of a technicality in the Medicaid provision. When I look at the labor website, it still says we don't qualify. Cuomo, way too much hero worship right now, it says in parentheses, said his congressional delegation is working on it. What's going on here? Why aren't people talking about this? Does anybody know anything about this?
Yes, it's because because before this whole thing happened, and starting with the budget, there was a $6 billion Medicaid gap, right?
There was a $6 billion. Libby, there was a $6 billion gap. He is saying the way to fix that gap is by offloading some of it onto the counties. The counties obviously can't handle it right now. That's the big dilemma.
Right, but then and he put together the Medicaid response team too, because he's had one before. And so the bill supposedly says you cannot make any changes to the way Medicaid is structured, and the governor is indicating he wants to do that. Whether he has or not is still needs to be played out, but that's what the why New York supposedly is not eligible for this money.
Now they can do that. I'm sorry, Libby, for cutting you off, but they can do it. The legislature can do it. They can do it in the budget. The problem he has is he set up this committee. Now, you know, when Cuomo sets up a committee and names the head of the committee, they have their orders, and they know what they're supposed to do. And what they were supposed to do is say, the county's got to eat more of it. But how can the counties in this situation eat more of it? How can the city of New York, which is doing everything it can to just keep up with this thing? But he's got a $6 billion deficit, which he has to deal with.
All right. Go ahead, Libby.
Well, I was just going to say that the two guys he put in charge for the task force were Ken Raske and Michael Dowling, two guys who are now playing a very important role in COVID-19 and the state's response.
Look, when you put somebody in charge of one of these things, you don't say no. You do what you're supposed to do. And what they have done, by the way, is to say, the counties have to eat more of this. Localities have to eat more of this.
We got this from Karen, who says this is on the presidential news conferences. One of many of the things that infuriates me about Trump's press conferences is that he uses them to push his own agenda by using them as reelection campaign rallies. Yesterday, he went off on a tangent glorifying himself by repeating over and over and over that he was selflessly giving up billions and billions of dollars to become president because he cares about America. So what billions exactly is he talking about? He still violates the Emoluments Clause by profiting from his businesses under the guise of having his kids run them. We also, Fred writes to us and says, this is in regards to our talking about Joe Biden, and he said, just counter-programming here, but Joe Biden is addressing the nation live at 10:30 on his website, so he is out there. Gordon wants
us
to know that.
I'm sure he's heard that people are disturbed by the fact that he has been quite silent.
Yeah.
And, the experts are telling him, you got to get out there, Joe.
This one from Ed on the food supply. I'd like to hear the panel's thoughts of it on if or when we in the Northeast can expect to see food shortages in the supermarkets. This is apparently becoming an issue in Italy. No surprise, given the nationwide lockdown. That's a great question.
Oh, we've already started seeing it. I mean, you go to the supermarkets here, at least in the Capital District where we are. There's not much chicken. There's been beef shortages. We're already seeing it, along with toilet paper and paper towels.
Well, how much of that, Libby, I really don't know the answer to this question, is a matter
of hysteria? Most of it.
Yes.
Most of it is hysteria. Absolutely.
Well, how much of it is just a stocking issue, and how much of it is an actual shortage? I think Judith Eng was on the show on Friday and said that a lot of this, that they have the stuff. It's just that people are buying it faster than they can restock the shelves.
Right.
If that's the case, well, that's great. But if we're running out of the stuff, then that's obviously very concerning.
So, there's a general issue here, which is America has moved to what's known as just-in-time supply. So instead of stockpiling stuff, you make more money when it just comes sort of the day before you need it. And Walmart is actually the place that really pushed this, and it's now become how things work throughout our economy. And so anything that's a real disruption is going to cause problems. Supply chains are also international. that some of the things we need are going to start being hard to get simply because our companies can't get the things they need to build them out of. It's not yet a crisis situation. We have a pretty good economy for building this stuff, but it does require management and it does require people who know what they're doing to be in charge.
And let me also add that some of this depends on how long this situation is going to go on. And, you know, at a certain point, you know, if food doesn't magically produce itself and be packaged and all of those things, will we need the military to help step in, Defense Production Act or something else to produce things that are non-perishable? Will there, if we're talking about fruits and vegetables and things like that, that requires people to be working on those food production issues, and does it require them to put themselves in harm's way to do that work? If we play this out over several weeks and into months, I think we're looking at a production issue as opposed to just what's available and can be put on the shelves.
I want to get, again, we're waiting for Governor Cuomo to take to the microphones at the Capitol and give an update on coronavirus. That is scheduled at 10:45, and we're just waiting for that to begin. And when it does, we'll go right over to it. In the meantime, we still do have some letters. I'm curious about, we have a letter from Julie, who writes to us and says, this is about the Peace Corps returnees, horrible treatment of Peace Corps volunteers who returned and then were terminated, no health insurance. This is the way we treat a Peace Corps worker who volunteered to help those in need worldwide. Any thoughts on this? It was quite a surprising and, I thought, jarring story that came out over the weekend.
Yeah, this is the first time in the history of the Peace Corps, which was created during the Kennedy administration, that they've been all returned simultaneously across the globe. And one can understand why that decision was made. But then to follow up and say, well, we're going to just terminate everyone and cut them loose, seems to run counter not only to the spirit of the work that those Peace Corps volunteers have been doing, but also the need to be able to continue to whether it's Peace Corps volunteers or anyone else, find ways for them to be able to sustain themselves through this emergency. I think it's an outrageous decision.
Does it? Do you have any sense that once you cut this off as it is, that the Corps can continue post coronavirus, and what the plans are, or it just seems that it's giving up on not only these people but also the overall mission.
You mean what are the plans kind of, you know, for Peace Corps going forward?
Right.
I don't know. I haven't read anything about that. I mean, certainly Peace Corps is dependent on being able to recruit very high quality people, and they've been incredibly successful at that. It's quite competitive to become a Peace Corps volunteer. So will this make that less attractive in the future? Perhaps so. That's certainly something that has to be considered.
So
the New Yorker,
please
go ahead.
Sorry,
Jim.
The New Yorker had an article on the shutting down of the Peace Corps in China, which happened prior to this. That's worth reading, and really does talk about this administration's general hostility to the Peace Corps. So
exactly,
it's just part of a package.
No, that's exactly right. Look, let's face it: the Peace Corps was a Kennedy triumph, Sergeant Shriver, and all of that. We know that. And this cannot be a healthy thing. I have a friend who came back years ago from India. He had severe problems, and the Peace Corps picked up every penny of it. So, you know, this is to be expected from this Republican administration, which doesn't like anything that any Democrat has ever done.
We got a letter from William.
It's because he didn't do it. You know, I'm sure we'll get a new version of the Peace Corps. It'll be called Trump Corps, and it'll be the same thing, but rebranded for him.
I'll bet we don't.
William writes to us and says, hey, the trucking industry has not stopped. We are working more. If fear stops, people stop hoarding, supermarkets could keep up. Thanks. So I don't think we made that point, but thank you for saying that. Important to know. Let's see. Tony says, Congressman Tom Malinowski told his district that our grocery store supply is fine. It is the hoarding that is creating the shortages, which goes to the previous letter. Then this is from another listener who's talking about the Affordable Care Act. Trump was asked yesterday whether he would reconsider his support of the Texas-initiated litigation, which has declared the act unconstitutional, in which the Supreme Court agreed to hear after the election. He said that is Texas's doing, ignoring his own support for it. Then he blatantly lied and said no one would lose coverage for prior conditions. If that suit prevails, the act will be instantly vaporized. That from Telesport. All right. Then.
Well, you know, Joe, we all have to get together. We can't be critical.
The governor is out, so we'll he is okay. Going to the microphones. We'll take that.
There we go.
Next.